everybody, and welcome back to Fueling Forward Friday. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former elite runner. Today's episode, I will be answering questions you all have submitted to me beforehand. And if you would like to submit any questions in the future, you can do so at my website, www.fuelingforward.com, under the podcast tab, or you can send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. Happy Friday. We made it again. Thank you guys for being here as usual. So let's see. This month, March, is National Nutrition Month. And yesterday was Registered Dietitian Day. And so I posted on my Instagram a little bit about my story of becoming a registered dietitian. But I wanted to start off today's episode talking a little bit about what it means to be a registered dietitian and how I got there. So just a few quick facts. There is a difference between a registered dietitian and a nutritionist. And dietitian is also spelled D-I-E-T-I-T-I-A-N. So not with a C in the middle, just something that irritates a lot of dietitians for no reason. It's just, you know, one of those things. It's spelled with a T, not a C. But anyway, we get called a lot of things, I think, by people who just don't understand that there is a difference between titles. So we're not nutritionists, we're not nutritionalists, we are registered dietitians. And this title is really important because it's a regulated title. So we have a licensing body, you know, just like physicians, just like nurses, just like psychiatrists, we have a licensing body called the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So we actually have to complete a bunch of prerequisites in order to become a dietitian. You have to have an undergraduate degree. You have to go on to get a master's degree. After that, you have to do what's called a dietetic internship. And it's not really an internship like what you would think of in a traditional sense of an internship. It's more like a residency program. So you have to complete a minimum of 1,200 hours of supervised practice in a variety of rotations. So it's more similar to like a residency program that someone would do to become a nurse or a doctor, where you have to have skills in a wide variety of areas. Once you complete your supervised practice, then you can apply to sit for the licensure exam. You take the licensure exam, and if you pass it, then you can obtain your registered dietitian credential. So it's quite a long process. And for me, it took 9 years to become a registered dietitian from the time that I started undergrad all the way through my dietetic internship program. And a nutritionist is very different because it's not a regulated title. There's no licensing body. There's no requirements to become a nutritionist. Anyone can call themselves a nutritionist. Like I said, it's not a regulated title. So the issue is that there can certainly be good nutritionists out there. You know, there are some nutritionists who did not go the dietetics route because it does take so long and it's so time consuming. So there are nutritionists who might have a master's in nutritional sciences, or they got their undergraduate degree in nutritional sciences, but they didn't want to go on to do the dietetics route. And so they have a lot more knowledge and a better skill set than a lot of people who, you know, call themselves nutritionists that didn't go to school for nutrition. So like I said, anyone can call themselves nutritionists. You can basically pay for a certificate online that calls you a nutritionist, and you can cheat on that test. It's just an online test. You just have to pass, you know, with whatever, 80% or more. And so it's not, it doesn't guarantee that the person who's calling themselves a nutritionist actually has that knowledge. And like I said, that's not always the case. There are some good nutritionists out there, but we have no way of knowing. We have no way of knowing one, a good nutritionist from a bad nutritionist, because it's not a regulated title. So a registered dietitian, all registered dietitians have completed the same schooling requirements, the same rotational requirements, the same licensure exam. So it's a standardized practice in that everyone meets the standard. So yes, of course, there's going to be dietitians out there who aren't great. And that kind of goes for any profession, right? There's doctors out there that aren't great. There's dentists out there that aren't great. But you will more often find somebody who's going to give you more sound science-backed advice if they have those letters RD after their name. So just a quick soapbox on what it means to be a registered dietitian and why it is so important to us that people understand that the title means something and it's not just kind of an umbrella term like a nutritionist. It's very different. And myself personally, I shared a little bit about my journey on Instagram yesterday, but when I was an undergrad at University of Colorado, I didn't actually know that I wanted to be a dietitian. I didn't even know that that job existed until I actually worked with a dietitian myself. So at that point, I was double majoring in integrative physiology, which is essentially pre-med, and then psychology. And I had decided to do 5 years in undergrad so I could take that fifth year to continue to run. And so at that point, you know, around my fourth year is when I decided I wanted to be a dietitian, which meant that I had to go on to grad school to get my master's in nutritional sciences. And I also had to complete something called a DPD program. So it's a didactic program for dietetics, which is sort of like the written program requirements in order to have the training in nutritional sciences necessary to practice. So while I was in grad school getting my master's in nutritional sciences, I was also taking all of the undergraduate prerequisites that CU didn't have. So my schedule was really, really full. It was really busy, but I loved my classes. So a couple of the classes, for example, you have to take a food service class where you learn about, you know, budgeting and quantities and how to order, you know, large quantities of things, purchase orders and all those kinds of things. You learn about school nutrition. So public schools have a very strict government guideline that they have to follow in order to meet all these requirements for subsidies. So in order to get government funding, they have to make sure they're providing, you know, the right types of nutrients to the kids at lunch. It's kind of like doing a puzzle. It's insane. That was one class you had to take. Food sciences, which was probably my favorite. We had a food lab. I think I shared this in another episode where you learned the science of cooking and it was so cool. So it'd be like, what do the different types of flour do? So you've probably seen like bread flour, pastry flour, all-purpose flour. How does the texture of something you're cooking vary based on the flour? And the difference is in the gluten protein content. So if it can become fluffier and more airy, is it more dense? It's really cool to learn the science of cooking. I absolutely loved that class. And another class that I loved was clinical nutrition. So initially when I was an undergrad, I actually wanted to go into something in the medical field, like nursing or, you know, PT or a PA or something like that. I didn't really know for sure. So I loved clinical nutrition because you're studying pathologies like kidney disease, diabetes, things like that, and you're learning about therapeutic nutrition approaches. So this is another area that's different between a nutritionist and a dietitian. A dietitian is licensed to practice something called medical nutrition therapy. So it's MNT is another term for that. This is a billable service by most insurances. And so this would cover, like I said, anything from kidney disease to malnutrition. And so when you go on to do your supervised practice, all dietitians are required to spend a minimum of 12 weeks in a clinical setting. And so when I was in my supervised practice, I was in a clinical, a hospital outside of Nashville. And I loved my hospital rotation. I thought it was so cool every day. It felt like, you know, Grey's Anatomy, where you're reading charts, you're learning about patients, you're rounding with doctors. You do different rotations too. So one of my rotations was in the ICU, and you do tube feed calculations for patients who are on ventilation systems. There's a sedative called propofol, actually, in the hospital that has calories in it. So if a patient is sedated, you have to calculate their calorie needs and their protein needs for tube feeds or IV feeds to avoid things like weight gain, which can cause bed sores, or, you know, there would be a specific burn unit where you would have to do calculations for somebody recovering from a burn. You calculate based on percentage area of body burned. So there's so many cool things that you learn as a dietitian that people don't really realize that we do. You know, I worked with a pharmacy tech to develop a tube feed formula for a specific patient who was dealing with a lot of different issues. You know, you work with patients who are recovering from drug addictions and are really underweight and malnourished. You work with patients going through cancer treatments and maybe they're extremely nauseous or they have mouth ulcers and they can't really eat. So you have to help them find an approach that allows them to get the nutrition they need to support their body in their healing journey. There's pediatric dietitians who work in pediatric locations. You know, it's really just a broad spectrum. Outpatient, diabetes, wound care. Nutrition is really integral in a lot of these areas of medicine. And so I just wanted to also briefly share that if you are potentially somebody who's interested in becoming a dietitian, there are so many things that you can do as a dietitian. It doesn't have to just be private practice or clinical. You know, again, you can work in a school district, you can work in a health clinic, you can do community outreach. There's just so many areas. So anyway, again, another plug for being a dietitian is that you get to do all these really cool science-related things, especially if you're somebody who's interested in the medical field, but you don't necessarily want to have someone's life in your hands. It's kind of a nice in-between where you're in the action and you're involved in this care team and you get to advocate for patients, but you're not necessarily responsible for their life. So it is a good, I loved my clinical rotation. I loved everything that I've learned along the way. So yeah, that's a little bit about what it means to be a dietitian, what it looks like for me to get to that point. Like I said, it was 9 years, took me a long time. And when I started fueling forward, it was because I needed more flexibility in order to train full time at the pro level with running. Most dietitian jobs are, you know, the classic 9 to 5, or if it's a clinical one, it's, you know, 6 to 3, kind of depends. And I did all that. I did that when I was in my supervised practice, and it was a lot. You know, I definitely empathize a lot with the athletes I work with today who are balancing full-time jobs with training. I know how hard it is, and I've been there. And so that's something that was part of my motivation for starting Fueling Forward, because I felt that it wasn't sustainable for me. And so when I started Fueling Forward, you know, I did end up working 2 jobs to support myself, because when you're growing a business, you can't necessarily live off that right away. I was living at home, COVID hit, so it was pretty eventful, but here we are 5 years later, Fueling Forward is thriving, and I'm just so thankful for everyone's support along the way. So just another, brief sharing of my journey. And a great intro into today's Q&A episode, where you get your questions answered by me, a registered dietitian. Okay, so our first question for today's podcast says, "Hey, I'm loving the podcast so far, both the stories and Q&A. I have 2 questions about race day and workout fueling. 1, I understand why fueling during marathons and really long runs is important. You can't possibly run that long without depleting your glycogen stores. But what about fueling runs 70 minutes and above, but not long enough that you will fully deplete your glycogen stores? I know fueling is really important for those too, but I'm curious why. And then 2, there seems to be a lot of opinions out there about the best carb source in gels. Is it maltodextrin, fructose, glucose, or is it just what's best in your stomach? Shelly." Great question, Shelly. Great multiple questions. So I'm going to start with the first portion of your question, which is, why would we want to fuel during runs that aren't long enough to fully deplete our glycogen stores, but are still longer than 70 minutes? So essentially, with any type of endurance training, and especially for somebody who, let's say, is in the middle of a marathon build, every single week, your runs are probably pretty significant in terms of length and volume, or maybe intensity. Your overall training load is really high. And if you're doing other things outside of training, like I just talked about working a full-time job, especially if you're on your feet or doing something very physically active, if you're, you know, walking the dog, walking kids to school, playing with kids, if you're doing a lot of activity in addition to your training, your energy needs are going to be really high. So one benefit to adding in fuel during runs that are 70 minutes or more is just adequate energy intake overall, especially if you're struggling to eat enough at meals. You know, I've kind of touched on this before, but it can be common to have appetite suppression happen as a result of training. Part of that is just something that can happen if we're training really hard. Sometimes it can be because your core temperature is too high, so your body's not able to send hunger signals. So this is definitely something that can mitigate some of that energy deficit just by putting a little bit more in during your training session. It's easier to hit your overall needs, especially if you're struggling with eating at meals or throughout the day. The second reason, it's not necessarily that you can't get through your run without fueling. You certainly can, but it does impact your recovery if you're really depleting yourself. And you can significantly deplete your energy stores, your glycogen stores, in a 70-minute run, even though you're not going to fully deplete them. You know, that usually takes about 2 to 3 hours of activity. It's still enough to, you know, if you're going to deplete your energy stores in 2 hours, that means after 1 hour of training, if you're not fueling, they're 50% depleted. So it still can be a significant amount of depletion, and it can be enough where, like I mentioned earlier, if you're not eating enough during the day or you're struggling to find times to eat enough, that over time, as you get deeper and deeper into your training block, that deficit will get greater and greater, and that's when you're going to be at a higher risk for injuries or overtraining syndrome or REDS. So it's also just about balancing recovery with your training volume. And what most runners will find, and this is something I personally found, is that adding in gels during longer runs really does improve your recovery. For me, I started adding in gels, and this was totally new to me. It's not anything I'd ever tried before. But I found that after my long runs, I felt so much better. Just the rest of the day went better for me. I had more energy. If I had to go to the store, it was easy for me to do that. I wasn't like dragging myself off the couch. And I think the other piece of that is when you have more energy outside of training, it's easier for you to put that energy back into things that will help you recover better. So like I just mentioned, going to the store and making sure that you have the food you need to support your training with nutrition, being able to make meals that are balanced and not just being so exhausted that you're throwing a box of mac and cheese on the stove every single night, which of course is better than nothing, but having more energy to make balanced meals is also going to help you feel better and train better. So it's not just about the run itself, because like I said, most of the time you can get through the run, no problem. I would say with a training block or with higher volume, I'm encouraging athletes to fuel more just because it's going to help with recovery. And then lastly, I think another benefit to adding in fuel during those shorter runs is a lot of times they're run at a harder effort or faster pace, and that's going to be more similar to your pace in a race itself. So if you're doing a slower long run, it's a lot easier to take in a gel, whereas during the marathon, you're going to be running a lot harder. So practicing taking in a gel when you're breathing harder, when your heart rate's higher, on those shorter, maybe more intense runs can also be a great way to figure out what's going to work for me on race day, because what works for you during a long run might not be the same thing that works for you during a marathon. And that, I would say that's especially the case if you're using something like energy chews. It's a lot easier to chew something if you're running slower versus if you're running really hard and you're breathing really hard. So just another opportunity to practice your fueling for race day and figure out what works well for you. The second part of that question, there's a lot of different gels out there. It seems like there's a lot of different carb sources being recommended. And I'm really glad that you brought this up, Shelly, because there is so much marketing behind a lot of these gels. So you've probably seen like the Morton gel, which has the encapsulated carbohydrates and a hydrogel. And you've probably seen Ucan, which is a superstarch. And there's just so many gel options out there. And what's interesting is that research does not actually show a huge difference in things like blood sugar response or even GI issues. It really depends on the person. So there are some people who love Morton and hate Goo, and there are some people who love Goo and hate Morton. And as a dietitian, the gel that I'm going to recommend to you is the gel that you're going to be able to get down. That's first and foremost the most important thing. If you can't eat the gel, it doesn't matter what kind of technology it claims that it has, you're not going to benefit from it because you can't consume it. So first and foremost is getting a gel that works well for you. Most gels, because we have a lot of research behind this concept, most gels will contain multiple sources of carbohydrates, so like glucose and fructose together. And the main reason they do that is because we only have X amount of glucose transporters in our GI tract, and then we have fructose transporters. You know, we have different ways to transport different types of carbohydrates. If we're consuming something that's pure glucose, we will oversaturate those transporters earlier, and then we reduce how much more we can take in until that has been absorbed. So essentially, you have to space your gels out more, and you can take in less if it's a single source of carbohydrates. Most gels, almost all gels I'm familiar with out there, contain a variety of carb sources. So that's really not an issue. Any gel that you like will often contain different carb sources. So I would say, as long as you, again, find a gel that's going to work well for you, that solution should already be included in the formula. Another thing to consider is consistency of gels. Some people have a really hard time, getting in thick gels. And so I prefer a gel that's really thin, almost like a liquid. So like Goo Liquid was something that I was using a lot. It's sort of like a concentrated sports drink. It went down really well for me, and it worked so much better, again, because I could actually take it and tolerate it. Morton is a lot thicker. It's more of like a jello consistency, so you almost have to chew it. I had one teammate who really couldn't get it down. She tried so hard mid-run, but it would just come right back up. And then I had another teammate who loved it, raved about it, only used it. So again, it's just so individual. It just varies so much from person to person. But what I would recommend doing is kind of finding the consistency that you like, the flavor profile that you like. So fruity, citrusy, you know, chocolate, savory. Finding whatever you like, and then just starting to do some research on gels that meet that profile. Some of the ones that I recommend the most would be like the Goo Liquid, SIS or Science and Sport. Those are a nice thin consistency. Honey Stinger can be hit or miss for people. I really like it. Some people really don't. Again, Goo tends to be one of the thicker, sweeter gels out there. Spring energy gels use real food. So if you don't like overly sweet things, that is also an option. And then you also have Morton, which is unflavored, and then UCAN, which has a variety of flavors. So many things out there. I didn't even scratch the surface on brands that are available, but just a couple things if you're interested in trying them out, that is where I would start. This next question says, any ideas for some lunches that are easy to pack and bring for work? Oh man, I don't know why, but I just feel like lunch is the worst. Lunch is always the hardest meal of the day. In my opinion, it's just a huge inconvenience. It's just something that I have to stop whatever I'm doing, whether that's working or, you know, whatever. I have to really take time out of my day to eat lunch. And typically for me, the foods I'm eating for lunch don't always give me a lot of excitement around eating, or historically they didn't. Like all of college, I think all of high school, I had the same exact lunch every single day, which I laugh looking back now. It was actually probably great because I was getting a lot of carbs in, but I was doing like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, an oatmeal cream pie, Little Bites muffins, and like some carrots. So I had, you know, my carbs, color, and protein in there. In college, I would eat a turkey sandwich with cheese and some carrots and some pretzels for lunch every day. So I think that was something I had a really hard time with when I came out of college. I mean, one, I didn't really have a super, well, I guess I did have kind of a structured day, but it was a little harder when you're at work, especially when you're working in a clinical setting, to cut out time to eat. And especially like hospital food, I didn't love it, but it was free, so I wanted to take advantage of that. So I think for me personally, lunch has always historically been a challenge, and it's something that I've really tried to approach differently over the years. And I really feel like in the last few years, I've gotten a good grasp on things that work well for me for lunch that keep things exciting. So I'm going to share a couple of things with you that I really enjoy. One is a quesadilla. I love a good quesadilla. You can put chicken on there. You can put black beans on there. I like to put avocado and plain Greek yogurt on top, like spread it on top. So it's like sour cream, but a little more protein. Put salsa on there. That's always a really tasty option that sounds good to me. And then I'll usually pair that with some type of like veggie on the side, and then some tortilla chips or something, depending on how big my tortillas were, to make sure that I would get enough carbs. A classic for me would be some type of like breakfast for lunch. So like an egg sandwich on a bagel I always loved, or like Kodiak cake pancakes with peanut butter and granola and some fruit on top. That was always a good one. Tuna, canned tuna or canned salmon or canned chicken are super easy for making quick things with protein that you can either put on bread as a sandwich, or you can, you know, use crackers or rice cakes to dip in or put on top of those. So that one I thought was a pretty versatile option for me that traveled fairly well. I know that it's generally frowned upon to eat tuna in the office, so if you can go sit outside and eat your lunch, that's probably what most people would prefer. But that is a super easy, cost-effective one as well. Bento boxes are another one of my favorites. So almost doing, like, I would call it like a little charcuterie board for lunch. It'll be like cheese and crackers and deli meat, apple slices, peanut butter, carrots, hummus. So sort of like a big version of like a snack plate. And then I liked to use bread and brie. That was kind of my favorite way to get extra carbs in with that bento box, and something that always tasted good to me. Soups are another thing that I love, and you can make a batch of soup on a Sunday, and you can freeze soup so that you're not having to get through it really quickly and eat it for like breakfast, lunch, and dinner in order not to waste it. Or if you have a family and you have people in your household that will help you eat it, making a big pot of soup over the weekend, great way to keep lunch more exciting and just have it ready to grab and go, especially if you have access to a microwave. A couple other things would be frozen options. So Trader Joe's has a ton of great like frozen meals, or they have frozen microwavable burritos. They have like the stir fry rice, they have fried rice, they have, Katie Rainsberger shared this in her episode, they have paella apparently that you can heat up, and she loves that. So I would say if you have some time and you have a Trader Joe's near you, spend some time looking through their frozen section and also their pre-made section. They have a lot of great grab-and-go stuff for lunches that require zero prep from you. Pasta salads are always really easy to throw together. I like to do pasta with those little tiny pearled mozzarella, halved cherry tomatoes, some basil, some chicken, and then just like olive oil balsamic. That's a really easy one to throw together. You know, some of those things, I would say those are kind of my biggest suggestions for lunches. And at the very least, you know, you can get a rotisserie chicken and you can shred it and use it in different ways for your lunches. You can make a rice bowl with it. You can make a wrap with it. You could put it on your quesadilla. You can make a chicken salad for your sandwich. You know, lots of variety within a rotisserie chicken by itself, and pretty cost effective. So just a few lunch tips for you guys. I do want to mention, if you run in the afternoons or if you run after work, I would try to err more on the side of a low fiber, higher simple carb, you know, moderate protein lunch. So like a rice bowl or a simple sandwich, something that's not going to have like a salad, for example, which is going to have a lot of fiber. I would avoid anything that is going to take longer to digest if you have an afternoon training session. Things like apples can actually be harder to digest before a run. So instead of an apple, doing like a banana, and then saving the apple for post-run, you know, playing around a little bit with lunches, especially if you train in the afternoon, really trying to focus on simple, easy to digest carbs, moderate protein, and really limit that fiber. All right, this next question: what should new parents eat as a middle of the night snack when feeding a new baby every 3 to 4 hours? Carson. First of all, Carson, congratulations. So exciting for you guys. I'm sure that you are feeling very happy and very tired right now. So you're doing great. There is a dietitian that I have known for a long time and follow on Instagram. Her handle is Fueling Former Athletes. And I have loved watching her journey. She has a 1-year-old now, and she posted a lot about her postpartum nutrition approach. And one of the things that she shared that I loved was that she had a little snack cart next to their nursing station. So she had like a little rocking chair where she would feed the baby, or her husband would feed the baby. And it was like filled with just snacks so that she didn't have to get up and move. Or if she sat down in a hurry and then was kind of stuck, she had some options available. So Katie, if you're listening to this, I'm stealing your snack cart idea. This is from Katie though. So she had this little snack cart and some things that you could put on there, Trail mix is always a really easy one. You can either put like single serve pouches or just a bag of trail mix or like a jar, whatever you have, you know, access to there. Bars that have carbs and protein. So some really easy examples would be like Clif Bars, Kind protein bars, Go Macro protein bars, or RX bars. Those are great options. It is cutie season, clementine season, so you could put a bag of those on the cart and then maybe pair that with something that has a little bit more protein. So you can do things like meat sticks. If you have time to go by the refrigerator, you could pair it with something like a cheese stick or two, some yogurt. Chobani makes these great drinkable Greek yogurts, which especially if your hands aren't free to just be eating something, those drinkable Greek yogurts are great. And then one of my favorite snacks in general are energy bites that you make with oats and nut butter and then any kind of mix-in that you like. There are so many recipes out there. I've seen like snickerdoodle ones, lemon poppy seed ones, just like a classic peanut butter and honey one. So Google that and look up some recipes for energy bites. And those, if you just put in a bag, you can set those on the snack cart and they're easy, you know, to leave out. You could put them in the freezer and then put a couple on the snack cart, you know, the night before you go to bed, just knowing that you're going to be up, you know, at the snack cart. Non-perishable things like those chocolate milks that don't have to be refrigerated. The Horizon chocolate milks, you could put that on the cart. I know it's not cold, but, you know, it would be there in case of an emergency. So generally, yeah, just a snack cart and some type of snack options that have carbs and protein. If you're more of a sweet person, you know, keeping that in mind. If you're more of a salty, savory person, keeping that in mind as well. Like, I would probably tend more towards, like, a chocolate chip Clif Bar than I would a meat stick at 2 a.m, but, you know, to each his own, whatever you like. So just stock up with some snacks and have those available for you in the night. And congratulations on your baby, Carson. Okay, I love this next question because I get asked this all the time. And it says, is overfueling a thing? I was marathon training last year for a fall marathon, and I was struggling with eating when I was not hungry because I knew I needed to eat, but then got freaked out that I was eating too much. Such a great question. And I will say, having been a dietitian working with runners for 5 years, I have yet to work with an athlete who's overfueling. I truly do. But I've worked with a lot of athletes who think they're overfueling. And it's really hard when you're training, especially for a marathon, to overfuel. I have also never worked with a runner who's eating enough carbs off the bat, ever. Men or women, I have never worked with a runner who's eating enough carbs. So I say that because most of those runners will tell me, oh no, I eat a lot. No, trust me, I eat so much. If you ask my friends, they'll tell you, oh, I'm eating all the time. Or I know my husband sees me eating. He knows I eat a lot. But it's actually not enough. And it's surprising a lot of times when you see how much you actually need versus what you're eating. There is usually a fairly big discrepancy for most runners. So first and foremost, I have never really seen a runner overfueling. You know, yes, overfueling, could it be a thing? Potentially. But is it really an issue I'm concerned with as a dietitian who works with runners? No, it's not. And I think the struggle with eating when you're not hungry is a common one for a lot of people. I think for some people, it can feel triggering, especially if you've had a history with an eating disorder or disordered eating, where you've been forced to eat when you didn't feel like it. You know, that can kind of bring up some emotions there. There can be this idea of like, I'm not listening to my body, and that stresses me out, which I fully understand. But I think something that can be helpful to understand is that you can have that appetite suppression that I talked about earlier in the episode with marathon training. And that's pretty common, especially if you're actually under fueling. So as hard as it can be, sometimes your body is not telling you that it's hungry because it's in a deficit and your body's not able to produce or maintain those appetite regulating hormones. And so you have that appetite suppression. And so if that's happening to you, if you're noticing that you're never feeling hungry, that could be a red flag that, hey, I probably need to eat a little bit more. And I think the best way to approach that, if you're struggling with periods of time throughout the day where you're not feeling hungry, is to try to get on a fueling schedule. So trying to eat every 3 to 4 hours. And if it's been more than 4 hours and you're still not hungry, then I would say that might be a situation where you're experiencing appetite suppression, and I would still go ahead and try to eat something. And if you're struggling to eat when you're not feeling hungry, I would recommend liquids. Liquids tend to be a really easy way to get something in, even if you don't feel like eating. So this could be things like smoothies or soups or a drinkable option like the Chobani drinkable yogurts or chocolate milk. Just getting some type of liquid option that has carbs and protein in will at least cover that base for you and give you a little bit of a cushion. Sometimes it also helps your appetite come back, and that's especially true if this is after a big run, and especially if it's hot out. A lot of the times the reason you're not feeling hungry is that your core temperature is too high. So having a cold drink like a smoothie will actually help lower your core temperature, which often does bring back your appetite. So I know it can be challenging in some situations, but like I said, try looking at how often you're eating. Has it been more than 4 hours since I ate last? If the answer is yes, then it's, I would say, okay, you know, it's time to try to eat something, even if you don't feel hungry. It can take a few weeks for your body's appetite hormones to re-regulate. So for a lot of runners that I work with who have been chronically under-fueling, it's hard. It's a hard couple weeks because we do have to push through some discomfort. But every single time at about the 2 or 3 week mark, all of a sudden they're like, oh, I'm actually hungry at this time now, and I'm actually craving that 2 o'clock snack instead of dreading it because I'm now feeling hungry. So your body sort of has to reset its circadian rhythm a little bit if you are trying to eat more consistently, and it'll take a little bit of time to get there. So just do your best for a couple weeks and give it some time, give your body some time to adjust. If you're noticing that you're not feeling hungry for like meals, for example, what you can do is try to look back at your day and figure out, am I eating my snack too close to dinner? Is that why I'm not feeling hungry? Or maybe I didn't eat enough earlier in the day and all of a sudden I had a huge lunch and a huge snack and now I'm just not feeling hungry for dinner. So if that's the case, how can I spread out my meals and snacks tomorrow so that I have more of a 3 or 4 hour gap before dinner, which should help bring your appetite back a little bit. So just being mindful too of if you don't feel hungry, why? You know, is there something else going on? Did you just chug a bunch of water? You know, water, drinking liquid stretches your stomach the same as eating food, which can create that sensation that you're full, even if you're not. So making sure that you are, you know, spacing out liquids and not drinking large quantities of liquids right before it's time to eat. Being mindful of fiber content, same idea. If you're eating a ton of fiber, then it's going to feel like you're really full all the time because it takes up a lot of volume, but it's not a lot of calories or carbs or protein, so your body's still needing more. So those are some things that can also throw off your hunger and fullness cues. So just getting into the habit of, instead of saying, oh, I'm not hungry, this is really frustrating, try to understand why. You know, your body is always trying to tell you something. We're just not typically that good at listening, and it's a skill that takes time to develop. Okay, our last question for today's episode comes from Izzy, and she says, I've been without my period for about a year, and sometimes I will go for longer than a full year without it. I'm going to be running in college next year, and I'm so scared that I will be susceptible to bone injuries. I feel like I'm eating enough, and I have gained some weight, but I can't seem to get my cycle back or have regular periods. What should I do? First of all, Izzy, I would say I think it's great that you are using your cycle as a marker of health and that you're able to recognize that I don't have it and that's probably not a great thing. That is not a mindset that a lot of runners have. A lot of runners will think, oh, if I don't have my period, that means I'm really fit or that's a good thing. So I really appreciate the fact that you're recognizing, okay, something's off. This is my body's way of telling me something's off. And I actually also love that you asked this question because I just recorded an episode with another dietitian, Riley Beatty. She has her own sports nutrition consulting business, and she's awesome. And we talked a lot about that in our episode. That's going to be coming out in April. So stay tuned for that one for more information on getting your period back as a runner. So I would also say, you know, you mentioned that you have gained some weight, but you're still not seeing a regular cycle. And for a lot of athletes, the weight restoration in and of itself isn't always enough to get your cycle back. Your body needs to feel safe and needs to know that it has enough resources to allow yourself to have a period. And the reason why our body shuts that off is because it's trying to conserve resources and put them towards more important things like keeping your heart beating, for example. And it also turns it off because your body doesn't have enough resources to support a pregnancy. So historically speaking, you know, back in the caveman days, the pregnancy wouldn't survive. So it's also kind of a survival mechanism that our body has. So if your body is not having a regular cycle, that means that it doesn't feel safe. So if that's the case, there are a lot of different factors that can contribute to that. Sometimes it does mean that you are underweight, but not always. Sometimes it means that your body fat percentage is too low, but not always. And I will say with that, I've had runners who have a period at 18% body fat, and I've had runners who lose their periods at 22% body fat. You know, those are such arbitrary numbers, and it really depends on the person and what their body needs. And it just might be a different number than you're expecting or thinking that you need. And I know that can be stressful to think about allowing your body to shift like that. But sometimes that is something that needs to happen in order for you to have a regular cycle. Something else that can be contributing to not getting a regular cycle is even if it feels like you're eating enough, similarly to the previous question about eating when you're not hungry, it can be that you're eating too much of things that aren't helping and not enough of the things that would help. So again, a big example would be eating a ton of fiber and feeling like your plate is really full and that you're eating a large volume of food, but there's actually not a lot there in terms of the carbs or protein. Eating enough carbs is a huge one for having a regular cycle. So if you're taking a look at your plate at meals, my suggestion is to try to make sure half of your plate, so about two fists, is coming from carbohydrates and only about one fist from color. So if you look down at your plate and you have over half of your plate as salad or veggies or whatever, then my suggestion to you would be to reduce that portion size and replace it with more carbohydrates, and specifically low fiber carbohydrates. Too much fiber can also reduce circulating estrogen. So that's something else that can affect your cycle. Another thing with getting your cycle back is actually stress management. That's a huge one. So if you have a lot of stress in your life, you know, trying your best to develop some coping strategies, whether that's seeing a therapist regularly, journaling, you know, going on walks, avoiding long periods of time scrolling on social media. Some of those things can really help, you know, taking care of your body overall, making sure you're sleeping, you're resting, you're recovering. And if you are training, something that you can try is just incorporating a rest day. So a day that is fully off, or a day where you are only doing 30 minutes or less of physical activity. That can just help get your body into a balanced state a little bit quicker. You don't need to stop training altogether, you know, depending on the person. We don't always need to do that, but it is something that can help get you back into energy balance more quickly. If you haven't had a period for a year or more, it can take longer to come back, but that's not always the case. Riley shares in her episode that she didn't have her period for a very long time, and she was able to get it back in 2 months. And I've seen that in my practice. I've had, you know, a couple weeks ago, I had an athlete who hadn't had a period in a year get her first period, you know, this month. And then I've had another athlete who has periods in the off season, but not in the on season. And it took us a little while to kind of figure that out for her. So it just really depends on the person and how big of a deficit you're in, how long you've been in that deficit, and how committed you are to getting that back. It does tend to be something that needs to be kind of an all-in approach. And so making sure that you are really committing to making those changes. And that's not to say you need to do all of that at once. You need to find an approach that feels sustainable. So if there was anything to start with, I would say just start by adjusting your plate increasing your carbs, decreasing your fiber. That's kind of where I would start. But if you haven't had a period for a year, I do think it's a good idea to see a medical professional, make sure that there's not something that you're missing, you know, from a clinical standpoint. There's not anything else contributing to that cause. I think it's great to get some blood work done, check in on hormone levels and see what those are looking like. And then also meet with a dietitian who can actually help you understand what your specific needs are, because everyone's are going to be a little bit different. You know, bone injuries, they are unfortunately a reality that can happen with long-term amenorrhea, because your bone density tends to decrease the longer that you don't have a period. So maybe getting a bone density scan and checking in on that and seeing what that looks like. And if your bone density is low, then adjusting your training volume. Maybe you do a little bit more cross training, a little bit more strength training to try to build back bone density while you're kind of working on getting your period back. And that way you don't have to fully stop running, but you're not putting yourself at a higher risk for a stress fracture because you're not continuing to run high mileage with low bone density. So if that's a concern, definitely something I would recommend checking in on. And then all the things that you would do to get your period back are also the things that you would do to restore bone density. So all those things are going to help you work towards that goal. But something I've talked about in other episodes with interviews especially is the importance of having some nutrition knowledge and some strategies in place before you go to college. That's something I would highly recommend to any high schooler who's heading to college, whether you're going to be running in college or not. I definitely encourage you, if you are struggling with your nutrition, if you are struggling to get your period regularly, this is a really good opportunity when you have more support and more resources at home before you move away, to kind of figure out that relationship with food piece. So again, if you, you know, are struggling, I highly recommend finding a dietitian. You know, I'm also here as a resource if you're interested in working with a dietitian. I do still have another spot available for this month for one-on-one coaching. So definitely feel free to reach out to me there. Thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. Next week is going to be an interview with runner Amber Scholes. Amber will share about her journey with college running and ultimately leaving collegiate running, struggling with an eating disorder, and finding her way in the sport. If you would like to submit any questions for the next Q&A, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.